Hey, hey, this is Cedric Jungelman, your host of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. Before we get into this fun rip where I get interviewed by fellow Bitcoin podcaster and my brother from another mother, Daniel Prince, on his Once Bitten podcast, I want to give a quick shout out to our sponsor, River. Why do I recommend River? Because I personally use the service and they offer zero fees on recurring Bitcoin purchases. You can dollar cost average hourly, daily, weekly, or monthly. Every Bitcoin is stored in a one-to-one multi-sig cold storage, meaning your assets are always accessible. Plus, with US-based phone support, help is just a call away. They also have this cool feature called Riverlink, which allows you to send Bitcoin via text to anyone, which can be claimed to any wallet. River makes it simple and secure to save your wealth in Bitcoin. Get up to $100 when you sign up and buy Bitcoin on partner.river.com/matrix. This podcast, from recording to editing to marketing, is 100% self-ran by yours truly. All boosts on the Fountain app go directly toward making future episodes as awesome as possible for you all. Value for value style. And now, let's enter the Bitcoin Matrix.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do you do? You get out.
Cedric, how you doing, mate? Long time coming.
I'm doing great. Very excited and honored to be here, Daniel. And Lauren, nice to meet you guys. Lauren via Zoom.
Lauren,
nice to meet you too.
So go ahead. What's your question?
How did you find Bitcoin?
I think Bitcoin kind of found me. I was on Twitter, probably hanging out on FinTwit, and Bitcoin has just kept coming into my feed, and they were sort of obnoxious the way they would kind of talk in sort of absolutisms about Bitcoin, and maybe a little toxic, if you will, and that kind of made me want to sort of challenge their ideas and put it in their face that they were wrong. And the more I looked at these ideas, the more I was really intrigued about Bitcoin. And, you know, I'll say it, you know, I came for the gains, honestly, at first, you know, the way they talked about it and what I could do with it. And it was one of the first things I ever really speculated on in my life. So that's kind of how I found Bitcoin.
Financial Twitter. So were you just following like stock markets and things like that just out of like personal interest? Or?
I think I was just hanging out on Twitter trying to understand Twitter. I came from Facebook in 2016 trying to understand the world, and Facebook was just not really a great venue for knowledge or signal. So I headed over to Twitter and I was really confused by Twitter and what to get from it, how to interact on it, how to have a voice on it. So I think just political stuff came into my feed, and maybe I think financial stuff. I don't know what financial Twitter I was following, maybe some macro accounts, or, you know, just kind of fumbling around. But Bitcoin is just kind of coming in, Cyber Hornets, and maybe this was in 2017 or late 2017 when Bitcoin was just booming. And it just was something where it was like, wow, this is anything like they're saying it is. Maybe I should take a stab at this. This sounds like really a once in a lifetime opportunity.
So, and here's like the thing, because we spend all of the time telling our kids, don't talk to strangers on the internet. Don't spend too many hours a day scrolling through and yada, yada, yada. Mm. I actually had the honor of introducing Jack Dorsey onto a panel in Madeira for the wow. conference there. And I just wanted to give a heads up, like, you know, Jack, I don't know how many people are, you know, directly, you are directly responsible for having them learn about Bitcoin, because I was one of them. If it was not for Bitcoin Twitter, I might have got there in the end, but my goodness, these guys, they would beat you up around the head. Like, you know, it's like being the new kid in the playground. And it's like, I remember like, whoa, these guys are crazy. I'll just sit back and watch for a few months and see what happens and what this, take it in. But the level of education that we've all managed to glean from it. And I think they were special days, like between 17 and Well, even today, you know, newbies coming in is still probably one of the best places to go and get diluted signal.
Yeah, I definitely think it's the best place to get some signal, specifically around Bitcoin. But I do think it's got a double-edged sword there. And I don't think I'd want my children or a lot of my family members on Twitter. I think that is can be a dangerous place. I think a lot of ideas are coming your way, and you have to think critically about them. What I loved about Bitcoin is that it's a ledger. I'm an accountant by trade. I still do my fiat accounting, corporate accounting consulting job. And I love that I could run the numbers on it and find truth. But you could find a lot of non-truths on Twitter that can be compelling or, you know, that you might want to look at. So I wonder how Jack Dorsey thinks about a lot of those issues. I wouldn't want my kids on Twitter or a lot of those platforms right now. And I have kids your age, Lauren, and you know, it's tough. I don't know, but I do think that it's an opportunity for critical thinkers who are interested in truth to grab on to the bull by the horns, because it's like a library. It's a giant, yeah, never-ending library, and there's all different kinds of content, whether you like audio or video or written, long form or short form. You want to be in a dialogue, a debate, or someone's investigative reporting. So the opportunities are boundless for information. And so,
any further questions?
No, I don't think so.
No?
No, thank you. All right.
You're saving them all for me.
Yeah.
Cool.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
It was so nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Right. So, wow, it was a couple of years ago I was on your podcast. It's gone so fast.
Yeah, it's like been like an eon. But you were one of the earliest guests to come on, and it was like episode 24. And it was such a, you know, so fantastic to have you on. And you've been a big part of my journey, specifically even not just your podcast, but your book, and kind of opening up and exploring and expanding that avenue. How to raise kids and homeschooling and world traveling. And I think that really segues and parallels nicely with Bitcoin in so many different facets.
It truly does. And most of the younger Bitcoiners that I meet at the conferences, they come up and that's what they don't want to talk about Bitcoin. They want to talk about homeschooling, unschooling, world schooling. And again, in Madeira, there was a couple of panels, one hosted by Lauren, actually, in the kids block, which was, it had me and a couple of other parents up there answering questions about, they were unschooling mums, you know, why not the education system? And then we had another one on the open source stage as well. And that was packed out. People are very interested. You know, if you've separated money from state, you will separate education from state at some stage, or that will be a very big question hanging over like your family choices. So it's really nice to see these conversations happening, because, you know, it's my belief that, you know, we're all trying to starve the beast here, and we can't keep feeding it our kids' hearts, minds, and souls from the age of 3, 4, or 5. Like we will never get over the line, because they'll just be indoctrinated, and it doesn't matter what you tell them at the dinner table. They'll never be able to critically think, and we'll just become, you know, fiat debt slaves like we ended up.
Yeah, I think that's still a possibility for wide swaths of society. And I think it's, I don't think a lot of people even realize what has happened to education. I mean, even on my own, you know, my parents were lifelong New York City public school teachers. I was, you know, public education was a cornerstone of society in my household. And I've had to sort of re-examine all those things. And just thinking about how money interacts with education, like you were getting at, and propaganda. And I think just with food, you know, you've had Texas Slim on the show, and what we've seen there. I mean, these things are just getting exponentially worse as the money gets exponentially worse. And we go up that S curve on how, you know, just debasing our money in our society.
I wonder, did your parents ever come across John Taylor Gatto's work?
That doesn't ring a bell.
Okay. He was a New York public school teacher for 30 years, I think. And he won a couple of awards when he was actually in the system, but he wrote the underground history to the American education system. And it's a tome. Like this thing is huge, right?
Right.
But he lays it all out there. And it's just interesting that he was one of the people that came from the inside stepped back, took a look at it and critical eye at it, and then went deep down the rabbit hole of research. And it was through his work, that book in particular, that I learned about the General Education Board and how that come to be. I told it on a few podcasts recently, but it's a direct tie-in with what they did in Jekyll Island, right? In 1910, they had the secret meeting, six or seven people, and they all gathered off in secret to figure out how to capture the monetary system. In 1902, they'd already pulled off this with the education system. They had a secret meeting, and they all got together, and they figured out, how do we capture and mold the education system to what we want it or need it to be for our best interests? And of course, hosting that meeting was none other than John Rockefeller. And the first guy to fund it was John D. Rockefeller of $1 million under the guise of philanthropy. Obviously, you know, we need to educate everybody, but we all know what's really going on. It's like, goddamn. Like, you know, when you learn about Jekyll Island, you were angry as all hell. And then when you learn about the General Education Board, you will be angry as all hell. It's like we have to just step away and build parallel structures. And that's what Bitcoin is doing and allowing us to do in other areas of our lives. So it's, I would say if you can get your hands on that book, get one. It'd be interesting, certainly, to put in front of your parents.
Yeah, no, I like putting that stuff in front of them. My father's not around anymore, but you know, it's fun to challenge them, and I think they get it. I mean, they were kind of foot soldiers to feed the family in a lot of ways, you know. But they're willing to entertain these conversations for sure. They taught in some of the worst neighborhoods, so it went way beyond education. I mean, it was shelter, it was food and nutrition in a lot of ways, and those schools were open a lot more than mine. So I would go in with them whenever we had holidays or days off or snow days they didn't get. So
well, what areas are we talking?
Oh, yeah. So my dad, he taught in Brownsville, Brooklyn, on the border of Brownsville in East New York. So way out in Brooklyn. And my mom, Far Rockaway, Queens. These neighborhoods have very limited access, like, to the subway systems, and are very far out and not a lot of prosperity. Yeah, it was a great experience. Kind of, you know, we were in the suburbs of New York City, so a little bit, you know, nicer. We weren't well off, but, you know, quite a contrast. And you could see where communities rally around these institutions, but they also take hold of them. There's a lot of politics, unions, and sort of, you know, you see how money's spent, how decisions are made. You see how, you know, decisions aren't made as well as in a for-profit setting. You see how there's different incentive structures. But, you know, I was going in there at 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old. I mean, what, you know, that's a lot of that's through osmosis at the time. Yeah. And I remember my father when I was very young, like, he's like, I'll be a teacher like you one day. He was like, promise me you will never, ever be a teacher. You know, and I don't think he was saying like, don't be an educator, but like, this is not a great life. And he felt like he was working too hard and just ate too much, I think, shit to want me to be in the same position.
So what led you then were you straight into being an accountant? Like, as you explained to Lauren, or?
I mean, I always was like sort of business minded growing up, kind of finance and economics oriented, you know, in like the eighth grade. Me and a few guys in a gifted program won the like Long Island stock market competition for middle schoolers. And, you know, I was always watching like things like Family Ties, and I was interested like Alex Bikini. But I had, you know, much liberal arts interests as well. And I wanted to grow up and be a film producer. But yeah, I went to college. I knew I wanted a career in business. I thought for a long time it'd be investment banking or finance. You know, as you get exposed to these areas, sort of, I think my soul just didn't want to really jive or vibe with them. And I just found, you know, I went into public accounting, and I found I detoured a little bit. I went to film school. I went into film production, and I just kind of in the film and TV industry, I just kind of fell back a lot on my finance and accounting skills and tried to help, and just fell into the roles of helping a lot of individuals and entities that just didn't have skills in that department. But Yeah, I like numbers. So yeah, I think I always wanted to work in money, but you kind of start looking at certain fields and you're like, oh, I don't think that's a way to, none of these things appealed to me in a way like I wanted them to be my life. And I wanted to go to conferences about being a public accountant and helping audit books. And, I didn't want that to be 24/7 for me and how their kids thought of their father. So I just sought out, I think, opportunities and roles that kind of allowed me to be a comfortable wolf and just get and extract what I could and wanted out of the system without giving up everything. So maybe not getting everything, but just not giving up maybe all my time and all my mental space. But that's a battle. I think I read your book and I've talked. I mean, you know what that's like and how soul draining those institutions can be. And I'm still in that, so those fiat minds,
Is that right? You're straddling both worlds right now.
Yeah, totally.
Right.
Very much still, in the fiat minds and corporate accounting. I work for a large, well, my client is a large Fortune 100 company, and I jump from various roles there, putting out fires,
Dude, and you're running a podcast at the same time. Like that's
Yeah,
a
well,
lot
that's a
of work.
passion project, it's a labor of love, it's not terribly financially fruitful, but I get a lot out of it, but it's a lot of time, it's a big burden on my wife and kids to kind of have that project on top of the job, and figure all that out. That's how much I love Bitcoin and wanted to have conversations with Bitcoin. And I wanted to stop bothering people in my real life who didn't want to talk
I was
about
gonna
it,
that was gonna
and
be the
there's
question,
a
like
whole lot of reasons I started the pod, but
these large corporations that you've worked for and helped, do they know that you're Cedric Jungleman from the Bitcoin Matrix podcast? And do they have any
No, not at
questions about
all.
that? No?
No, I wouldn't hide it. And when I was, I haven't been in an office in 4 years now. And I've kind of, when COVID hit, none of us were in the office. And after about 2 years of that, we moved, and all my work and clients are still back, where it was. And they just take me on because I can get stuff done from wherever I am. And I was 3, 4 days remote, or 2, 3 days remote anyway before that. And no, they don't really know. But like when I was in the office, I would talk to like some what I thought might be like sleeping lions, or people who kind of interested in these things. And I also like to run like just sort of like objective surveys. So I could either dribble out a little information, no information, just see how people respond and just kind of do test cases. Because, I know that Bitcoin Twitter and Bitcoin podcast could be a bubble. And it's nice to just bounce things off people or see what happens to them over time if you touch them on the Bitcoin thing. But in the last 2 years, no, I don't bring up that I live in a nice sunny place. I don't bring up Bitcoin, none of it.
That's
So
crazy. Like to like because you've had the best of the best on the show, right? Like the biggest of
yeah,
the
no, and
names.
they no, but I don't even know if they would know those names.
They will one day, that's for sure, right?
Sure,
They must know
and
a
anyone is,
sailor.
I don't know. I've
Really?
sat down with like $1 billion, like the VP of finance control of a $1 billion company. This was 2.5 years ago, and I was, they were going through this process. This is great. They make appliances and glassware. So they use palladium and rhodium and gold in their manufacturing and production process. But there's zero waste. There's no leakage. They have 3 ounces of palladium, and you're gonna fire up the ovens and still have 3 ounces. And they owned all this. And as I was onboarding, they had just finished up doing a huge sale leaseback, right? They sold the hard assets and were now leasing them. And this was all in the, trying to raise cash. So they were moving everything to cash. I mean, this is 2.5 years ago. Because they were PE owned and they weren't going to be able to be sold. And so I got to pay off some loans and this, that, and the other. But like, I was like, hey guys, you're sitting on $100 million in cash. And I brought this up to control, but the controller's brand new, the CEO's brand new, the CFO's brand new, the CMO's brand new, the COO's brand new, right? So none of them have political capital. And none of them have sway in the organization. Who's going to put their neck out on the
No
line? And
one, because
right. And the
the controller
controller,
is.
yeah, he was kind of playing with crypto. He kind of understood these hard asset things, but he was like, who's going to listen to me? Now, if they put, you know, 1 to 10% into Bitcoin at the time, I mean, they would have solved their problems in 6 to 12 months and in 2-3 years would have obliterated, you know, their issues. You know, but that's not an easy, it's a conversation of two, and you need like 20 people at the organization willing to put their neck on the line to get something like that across.
Oh, it's so crazy how so far, like, you know, if you're not watching the story of MicroStrategy as a CFO or as a CEO, you know, this is a publicly listed company. This is on the NASDAQ and has just obliterated any other stock out there. How is no one still asking that question? And with all the ETFs now, you know, all of that noise as well, it's madness that it's still...
Michael Saylor, though, I mean, first of all, they had $500 million of reserves. And he understood that you can't liquidate that or give that back to shareholders. You got to keep the lights on, your promises to stakeholders and clients and customers. And so he gets that. But he also has a large stake in the company. So he could say, we're going to go on this investigation and all of you need to read these three books and listen to these seven podcasts and get back to me with your thoughts, arguments, and ready to have a debate. No one else in any of these, they're like, what do I need to go do to go home at 5 o'clock? Mm-hmm. What do I need to go home at 7:30 tonight? You know, what do I need to just go home and like make it to the end of the quarter so that like I can get a job somewhere else? And you know, I don't know, all these organizations that, you know, the CFO comes in on day one, he's like, I'm here to cut costs, you know, and he's got, you know, he's going to be here for 18 to 36 months. And basically he's just going to go through the whole organization with a ratchet. You know, I'm at the kind of Fortune 100 company where they need to cut costs. They told Wall Street, we're going to cut costs. They will literally say, you know what? It's 7 o'clock tonight. Put out a memo that at 6 a.m. every consultant around the world is on frozen for the next 30 days. Every single consultant, whether they're backfilling a job, whether they're on a special project, every single one. We have 6,000. Okay, 600 get carved out. The other 5,400 gone. Okay, at noon, we get a call from London. Wait a minute. The people that are supporting the stores in London are United States contractors, and we don't have anyone on the phones. Okay, get those guys back, right? Like, this is how it's done. There's no like, hey, where are we going to be in 17 quarters? Or, you know, it's like, hey, we're a healthcare company. We're benefiting from COVID. We're going to have sales up to wazoo. No one in FPA goes, hey, maybe we're going to have to pay the pharmacists more money to dole out the drugs. You know, maybe if the pharmacists don't show up, we're going to close stores or have limited hours and we don't have the throughput. Like FPA, everybody's like, well, everything's going to go up by 2.75% next year because Powell said, you know, that whole organization is just a complete waste of time, energy, effort. There's no real direction coming out of what? Audit. There's no value add coming out of FPA. There's no mark to market at anywhere in the world on any of these assets. Do you think anyone's at CBRE going, you know, maybe we should start marking everything down 25, 30% because every office? No, they're saying, you know, I think things are going to bounce back. We're going to get people to come back to the office in the next quarter. And we, you know, I mean, none of it's real. And nobody cares about the long term. Like, you know, they're all LARPing. You're all role playing. Like, you're at the meeting. You just say what you know you need to say.
It's so true. And that's why that is the stark difference with Saylor, because of like the way he was so integral and integrated into like his own company, like, you know, that
longest running public CEO of in history.
Right. So how does no
one
know?
Been through these ups and downs. Have you seen his early interviews where like, he's in board meetings? I've read these. Like, he's in a, I don't know if it was Vogue or someone did like a 20-page interview of him like in 2002. I mean, he's been through accounting scandals, he's been through the dot-com, he's been through the software boom. Like, he you know, you can go back to interviews and he'll the passion he's had for everything he's involved in and believed in, and the conviction, because he's putting in the work and he has the vision. is astounding. But it's not unusual for him, I think, to really be visionary and to see things like this and to really want to be a part of helping. And then he's, you know, because of his experience as a CEO, which is essentially a, you know, a salesman or an actor on behalf of the company. I mean, his oratory ability is up there with like Marlon Brando, mm-hmm. you know, and then he has he can write his own script. So that marriage is amazing. And then to have the belief in Bitcoin, wow, it's just, you know, it's an interesting person in the world today.
So what I'm hearing you say, Cedric, is don't hold out for any big announcements too soon from S&P 500 companies that are going to put Bitcoin on the balance sheet and have that as you know, the center point of their growth strategy over the next 5 to 10 years. Because no one gives a fuck. It's just about getting through the next few quarters.
You know, I'll never say no. I mean, you know, we're getting into prognostications. And I hope I don't want to be right on that one. And I don't see how they don't wake up. I mean, their fiduciary duties being just it's beyond negligence. It's practically criminal.
It is.
So, you know, and Larry Fink is now blowing the trumpet. So I think that kind of changes things. The Bitcoin will be discussed way more in CNBC. Every one of these executives, when you log into your Fidelity, your Wells Fargo, your Merrill Lynch, like whether you're in the Bitcoin ETF or not, you're going to see those percentage gains posted with the DGIA, with the S&P, with the NASDAQ. It's going to be so in their face. But no, I don't expect, you know, a stampede of mission-driven companies. But I do think when MicroStrategy is in the S&P 500, and 18 months from now, when all these high net worth individuals just called up their brokers and said, yeah, just give me a 10% allocation to this Bitcoin thing. Move, you know, give me 50% of whatever I have in gold in that gold ETF and get it over there. I think, yes, things start to really change. And maybe it's more of a slow creep. Like we bought 100 Bitcoin today. You know, it doesn't have to be like we are now going to, you know, but in 5 years, I mean, how could not every public company have a chief Bitcoin officer? Because what Saylor has done, and I think about this with your own personal life. So Bitcoin, you know, is very powerful from when you get your first few sats and you got sovereignty and immutability. But this unit of account thing is really, I mean, like when you think in Bitcoin, personally, professionally, as a corporation, it transforms your balance sheet. And your ability to manage risk and volatility and understanding of it through your own going through some cycles. So, you know, when Michael's when Bitcoin goes up, what, $1,000, MicroStrategy's balance sheet gets what, like a $250 million equity infusion, which is 3 to 5 years of net income that he's got 2,000 people. Busting their humps year round, giving up time with their family that he's like, yeah, no, stay in Hong Kong for 3 more days, close the deal, don't come home. Like, and they're just making that like 15, 30 times a year when Bitcoin goes, I mean, just utterly changes that company. It makes it a Berkshire Hathaway. And it just starts to eat everything. First, now we can capital allocate on a basis he didn't have before and just buy things that maybe are valuable or going to be valuable. But people just want to give him money and he can then go and speculative attack Wall Street. And we, you know, we have this debate on Twitter, whether it's better than the ETF, you know, whatever, but like he can do these things for the shareholders that mm-hmm. are there now or want to come on board. And he's a large shareholder.
This recent offering, I think it was 500 million or 600 million. Or two tranches of each of the, I can't remember exactly. Did you see the amount of like interest he was offering for that?
It was like 75 basis points or 65
0.86%.
basis points. 6%. This is insane.
People are falling over themselves. To
right.
Take
and I'm not recommending people go out and get leverage, but this is no different than you taking out a HELOC to unlock equity in your home or whatever it might be to get some debt. But he's getting the debt incredibly cheap and he has a business that brings in income. So, you know, you can't compare. Everyone's situation is not the same. But he has the ability to manage this. But what it's done, and then I think what they're going to do with Lightning, putting MicroStrategy products on Lightning, business intelligence on Lightning, all of a sudden now go from maybe, you know, a not so exciting business software company, intelligent company, to, you know, next level world class deliverer of what could be a whole suite of products, especially when, like, why aren't every single awards at every single company sats on Lightning? Right? Just get rid of your rewards program. Just give me sats. Now they're universal. Mm-hmm. I go to Starbucks, which I don't go to Starbucks, but you know what I mean? You go to Starbucks, you fly in United, wherever you do, wherever you spend your money, you get a few awards. Well, aren't you giving me sats? Your 401k, as soon as you sign up with your company, like through Microsoft, Office 365, you got a wallet, you can get some sats right away for, you know, your employee through your 401k half contribution, you get sats back. I mean, all different things. So he can embed all those products in his company. And so it changes the balance sheet, and then it changes the, you know, the income statement and the statement of cash flows. So,
man, it must be so interesting for you to look at this from someone who's, like, you know, deeply rooted in that accounting fiat world, and then just to see what's going on in the Bitcoin world. How are you, oh man, you must be so conflicted. Like,
it's like having a death. I don't know. You ever experienced a death and like. And like the world just stops, like, you know, you see the leaves floating and you're just like, everything's different now. Like my best friend's gone or my dad's gone and like nothing matters. And like, I had that moment listening to like a Bitcoin Tina podcast, like, whoa, like I walked out of this huge corporate building and you're just looking at the world around you and people are running into CVS and they're running into, do you have Boots, you know, or like different pharmacies or different corner stores. And it's like, they don't know. They don't know, like, this is, it's not everything changed. Like, I just found out, like, not like, you know, it's a discovery and I just found out about it myself, but like, they don't know. And like, it's going to be years before they know. And that's something you learn is patience. And that's what, you know, I mean, the journey, you know, from you find this thing, you might, you know, you, I said earlier, you came for the gains, but I stayed for the money. I stayed for the unit of account. I stayed for the knowledge. I stayed for the camaraderie. I stayed for being around other truth seekers. But it's not even about I'm a loner a bit, but like I just been on my own path of just always seeking truth. And I found something that like I couldn't, there was no more need for debate. You know, in the political sphere or any other spheres in your life, you can kind of get into debates with people and you can have strong conviction and you could feel that they're wrong or something, but you can't prove it. You know, there's a lot of things you can't prove. With Bitcoin, you can prove something. And no one, you know, in the world of business, whatever it is, there's always various kinds of risk. You know, partner risk, you know, who you're in business with. They're drunk, they're cheat, whatever it could be. They're not good at business. They may, their ego. You real estate, you have location risk, you have fashion risk. You know, you open up a bar, maybe the mayor doesn't give you the liquor license. And this other guy had an inside track. Whatever it is, all these various risks that you cannot mitigate or get to zero. And my whole life, I was looking for something where there was no risk, that it was just a no-brainer. Not necessarily a no-brainer for everybody, and you know, there's no opportunity, you know, but something that is like, but even if it was, you know, just something that no one could get between me and the thing and debase it or take it away or anything of that sort. And that's on top of, you know, just, you know, before I found Bitcoin, you know, you spend 30% of your time, you know, I try to spend all my time at work and then go home and be with my family. But now I'm spending a half of that time trying to figure out the perfect portfolio, which is just trying to recreate money because the money's broken. And you're like, how do I get this basket of goods that's going to be like the perfect money and just maintain or maybe hopefully increase my purchasing power? So, you know, as someone, you know, public education and went to school, got a, you know, bachelor's of science and finance and a master of science and accounting and steeped in Keynesian economics, all of a sudden now, you know, you're learning about Austrian economics and, you know, cryptography was never something that I was spending. I mean, that sounded cool, but I was never like, well let's go spend an hour on cryptography. why is immutability important? You know, and I honestly thought blockchain was the value add in the beginning, you know, a triple ledger accounting, and we were going to not just dematerialize money, but we were going to continue on this path. And, you know, it's embarrassing now. There's no value in a terrible, you know, database, but, you know, trying to understand this thing is, you know, great. We fixed the money. We got this 21 million, but what else can we fix? And, you know, I got this new tool and
You know, just like in the legacy financial world, I'm going to diversify. You know, why I got digital gold. Why wouldn't I want a little digital silver? Maybe a little digital copper, you know?
Yeah.
And you got to relearn a lot of different things. And that's what's fun about Bitcoin, is challenging yourself. And it's very humbling.
And I see your stack of books looks very much similar to mine. So I got to ask, when you started changing, because that's what happens to us, what were your wife and kids saying? Because, you know, here's dad, Mr. 9-to-5, fiat corporate guy, does his thing. That's nice. But now he's talking about this other thing, which is a complete opposite to anything he's ever believed.
Yeah, so I don't know. I think it was more like, you know, here he is. He's got another thing that he's latched on to, right, and won't let go.
What
of.
Is it
and
now?
What is it now?
Why can't he just
and
go?
When is this going to end? And, you know, when is this phase going to be over? And I'm not so much a phase person, but I do latch on to things. I'm going from thing to trying to find it. And, you know, thinking about sort of like the podcast, this was the first thing that, you know, my wife was the first one-way trading thing I'd never want to let go of. But like, it's a topic that was endlessly fascinating and just wouldn't be exhaustible. And I think, you know, I've always wanted to do something like a podcast. And there's so many reasons I started a podcast and when I did, and a lot of that too with COVID. One of them was, you know, I'd be coming home talking about, you know, this cartoon character on Twitter that's going to change my idea about the whole financial system. And I'd be trying to convince my wife of these ideas. And eventually she did become a Bitcoiner. And one of the reasons, you know, I'd be coming home and she'd be listening to McCormick every day in the kitchen. And he's got a nice British accent.
Like, I was going
to
say, maybe I should start the accent.
Well, so, you know, let me put my hat in the ring and maybe you'll listen to me, you know, like, but, you know, yeah, I mean, I think that I don't know if they see the change now yet, because I think it was just another thing. And one of the things I started the show was so I could stop talking and bothering them about it. And talk to people who wanted to talk about it, and also talk to people who wanted to take the conversation further, and not just let me unload and download and offload and, you know, sort of harass them. My kids were very young, you know, so I read them books and stuff, but they're like, get it, Dad, Bitcoin's the best money. Leave me alone. You know, I got any money, you know, like what am I going to do with that information?
How old are they?
11 and 7.
Younger than Bitcoin.
Yeah. Yeah, younger than Bitcoin. So they're just going to grow up in it, you know? Yeah. And so, yeah, I mean, I just remember, you know, COVID came and now I was just permanently not going in the office anymore. So now all of a sudden I couldn't just like take an hour and a half and skip out of the cubicle and go listen to a pod during lunch or back and forth on the commute. And I had to sort of defend that time. Like, hey, I'm going to go walk for, you're going to go do what? Like, why aren't you fixing that light bulb? Why aren't you doing your home, you know, get some things done. And you got a minute. And I wanted to defend that time. But I recognized that COVID, just like Bitcoin, was going to change everything for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, if I don't come out of this with a new skill and use this as an opportunity instead of just sitting here and, you know, and, you know, I was getting some feedback. People would be like, oh, why don't you start a podcast? And I didn't want to be on a soapbox. But one of the things I thought about was, unlike any other world that I was interested in, like I had access to Bitcoiners that people would be interested in hearing. So I could DM Pierre Richard, who I once tried to hit up for an accounting job at Kraken, you know, and I drunk DM'd him on a Saturday night, you know, hey, Pierre, I want to start a Bitcoin show. I have no more excuses not to do this. Would you come on the show? And at 8 a.m., you know, he's like, yeah, I'm in. Like, why don't we do it this week?
That's the key. I just want to stop you there for anybody else listening. And cheers, by the way. Lauren just snuck me in a beer. So what do you have? What are you packing?
A double IPA from a local brewery in Florida. Beautiful.
I've got a local IPA from one of our local breweries. But you said the key two words there. No excuses. And that was the same.
I ran out of them.
When I realized, okay, like Your barrier to entry is zero. I'm like, how many excuses do you need to keep telling yourself? You have a laptop, you have a pair of headphones, and a free Zoom account. You're done. You are done. And you have this burning desire.
I didn't even know it was that easy. But you have barrier to entries. I ended up thinking I didn't have a microphone. I didn't know you could just get Zoom and it was free even. I just didn't think about any of this. So we had a friend of a friend who was doing podcasts and they were using a producer. So like I hired a producer, which I 6 weeks in, I found out not your keys, not your show. Right. And, you know, I had a fight over getting my show back and I was willing to throw the whole thing in the garbage if I couldn't get my keys. But yeah, I ran out of all these excuses. I had the time now, or at least I really wanted to do the work. I wanted to listen to more podcasts. I wanted to read books. So I wanted to defend it. Like, I'm doing this for the show, guys. Like, it's not just for me. And I wanted to ask questions. I would listen to podcasts and I remember looking, you know, I started, you know, you do a little market research. I'm like, how many Bitcoin podcasts are there? Is, you know, where would I fit into the mix? And I literally going through the matrix. I'm like, is anyone else from New York? I don't see that. Okay. Like, cause I know Princey's got this great accent. People like that. And, you know, whatever it is, people, you know, so I'm like, okay, is anyone around my age? Well, I'm like, well, Princey's around my age, guys, but you know, he's in Europe. I got a different accent. So, and I remember looking at him, like, Princey wrote a book. Well, you know, that's not an excuse not to do the show just because he's got a book. Like, you ran out of them. And I think that just like then, and I'll say it now, like there's going to be more content, whether you think you're late now, you're going to think you're late in 4 years from now. And basically, in anything you do, you're never too late. There's always going to be a need for more voices, more people to relate to certain things. And everyone goes through their podcast journey. Like they listen to this kind of podcast for 9 months because they like the host, or they want to listen to something philosophical. They want to gain conviction. They achieve all those goals. And they're like, I want to learn more about security now because now I'm really in and I've learned a little bit and I have a little stash and I want to figure out what to do with it. So I got to spend some time over here. Or maybe someone's like, oh, now that I'm here, I want to do something entrepreneurial. So I want to listen to this kind of podcast, or I want to listen to someone more like me, or I want to listen to someone less like me and challenge myself. And so it's always going to be new voices. And you're always amazed. You look around and be like, wow, well, this person's doing it, or that person, or they just started. Well, they're always, not all these people are going to last. I mean, you know how much work it is.
Yeah.
It's like a full-time job. I do a lot of it during my job. I sneak it in and I try to get it all done. And so it doesn't interfere with the rest of my life, you know, but it's an incredible, just booking people is a job. Mm-hmm. I mean, early in the beginning, I mean, I can't imagine, you know, I can't even imagine going back to the beginning and redoing it, but climbing that mountain. But like the courage of Bitcoiners to come on the show before I even put out work. But, you know, the other side of the coin is like, you haven't put out any work or you haven't put out much work and they might show up late. They might cancel. And it's not because they're bad people or something, but like they have very busy lives, you know, and most people have been so kind, so generous, but like over 187 episodes for myself. I mean, there's been a cancellation and there are times where like I try to do my thing in the nights and evenings. But there are some guests where I'm like, okay, we're going to squeeze this in and do it. And I take a day off from work and they cancel that morning. You know, I burn a PTO day or, you know, that kind of thing. There's a real cost to it. You know, because I think a lot of people think like, oh, I'm just going to whip it together and turn on Zoom and we're just going to have fun, you know? And like, I think there's space for that. And if you can nail that, but like, I try to like, I do a lot of preparation. I want there to be a lot of signal per minute of the show. I'm like, for me, it's a once in a lifetime opportunity to talk to these people. So I'm like, I want to make the most of it for myself. Because when I started the show, something I said to myself is like, what if I'll record a bunch of these? I don't have to put them out.
Mm-hmm.
And if I, what if they're no good? I don't put them out. But if I do like them and I put them out, who cares if anyone listens? Like for me, at the minimum, it was a time capsule for my children. Because
right.
I was like, here we are in COVID. Here I am new to my Bitcoin journey. Like, how can I give them some sort of roadmap? Maybe we won't find the answers on these shows, but at least they'll hear my questions, like what I think is important to kind of figure out. And that's also something that's interesting with shows, because you get into this whole thing about like, who should you have on the show and purity tests and, you know, this, that, and the other. And, you know, I try to, For my show, I try to feature the guests, let the guests speak, but also let the audience think for themselves. I mean, obviously, I'm going to counter if I complete this, but I'm trying to invite people on the show that I agree with most of the things I say, or not agree, but I think their ideas are interesting and worth thought and consideration. And if 5% of what they say is not where I agree, like, I don't know if I need to make a mountain of that all the time, depending on how egregious it might be. But I let the audience think for themselves, you know, and have that opportunity to hear from the guest, you know. And I don't think going into a place and hearing things that you don't agree with is necessarily the worst thing in the world. I think there should be more of that in the world. I think I wish people would share more of their real opinions in the public sphere.
Yeah, so. Absolutely.
Sorry
more
for that
open
ramble,
dialogue.
But...
Have you, I had a question on the tip of my tongue there. And people also think about, should I start a podcast? How am I going to monetize it? And that's the first thing that comes across their minds. And thankfully for me, I never, ever thought about that. And I think that's what really helps. So if anybody's listening and you're listening to this and you're like, okay, yeah, but you've got show sponsors. Cedric's got a few. I've got a few. Obviously, some of the bigger names have crazy huge ones. Don't go in with that mindset, because you'll give up after like 10 episodes or something.
Well, I don't think there's a lot of money in podcasting. And I value my sponsors greatly, but I went into it sort of like you, like not caring about sponsors because I had my day job and I didn't need sponsors. And I kept that attitude. And I do the show for me 100%. And I only take on sponsors that I believe in as much as I can, know about any company, and will offer value, but will not give me any sort of like, what are you doing here or there? And no one has.
Yeah. Do you have any written contracts or anything like that? Or is it just all kind of gentleman's agreement? Let me share your product. And
I haven't done a contract. I think if any of their departments have sent me a contract, and that's a whole full-time job, just like trying to get sponsors, talk to them.
Yep.
And I don't think until you're in the upper echelon is there really, you know, but to do it for the money would be a whole misnomer, just even if it eventually got there, because you won't get there to what you're saying. And I think that to the extent for me that any money is involved, it's to just justify the time away from my wife and kids at this point. I would literally make more time Ubering. I enjoy this more. So I'm willing for the cost benefit. I get a lot out of it. I get to ask the questions I'm interested in. For me, it was a really big deal, like to go to conferences. And I wanted to be someone at a conference who's contributing in some way. And so I've gotten a lot out of it from that, the network, the knowledge I've gained.
I was going to say that's the hidden value, isn't it? When one of the conference organizers reaches out and said, would you mind coming along and just hosting a panel? Like, because you're a shoo-in, right? You're used to interviewing people and you've probably faced the people on the panel before. Many people organizing these conferences around the world are not conference organizers, haven't been beforehand. And we're all just plebs just mucking in together trying to make this thing work. And that's what I found, like, wow, if the podcast has given me anything, it's this ability to, you know, add value in some way to the conference. And it's just very humbling in a way to be invited along to them and to be part of the conversation.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the conferences, especially when you're early on in your journey, they're really hard to think about whether you should attend, whether you should spend your hard-earned money on that instead of getting sats. Especially, I remember at the earliest conferences I was thinking about attending, you know, like deepest bear market, I'm down in dollar terms. You know, wife and kids haven't bought into this thing yet. You know, I use that word bought loosely, but, you know, understand where this is going and why we're doing this. And then just, you know, think, you know, especially, you know, if you might, that might be a sizable amount of stats you might be able to add to your stack. I do think there's tremendous value in meeting Bitcoiners though, and finding that there are other like-minded crazy lunatics like yourself. I think that's been invaluable. I'm a bit of a loner, so I might even be at the conference like off to my side, you know, or like, you know, but introverted, but we'll talk about Bitcoin kind of thing. Yeah, this, but I think that's really hard. I think for people who haven't met people in real life, I can't imagine what that's like, but I also understand sort of like, well, I haven't met anyone in real life. What could that really bring me? And should I just stack sats with this? Especially in those moments where like you are on an island and it's a bear market and no one believes you. And it's hard, I think, to take time off from work to do that. So it's just also the time. It's mm-hmm. like, okay, I'm going to spend money and then take time off, which is a cost, and time away from family, you know. Now my wife's like, another vacation for yourself. Like, you know, so now I won't really go unless she can come and we can enjoy it together. And she's a Bitcoiner and she gets it, you know. But, she, you know, it doesn't, some people too. And this is something hard that's like, you know, like sort of identifying as a Bitcoiner, because I try not to identify as anything. I'm just me. But if there's anybody I feel camaraderie with, it's Bitcoiners, you know, but there's more to life. Bitcoin's a tool to, I think, make your life better. And I think that's a big part of why I started the show was this notion of like, I you know, like, oh, I'm just going to stack sats and everything's going to work out. Like, I think that can work out and will mathematically, but I want to be a part of contributing to, I guess, a better world or a better place or just a better life for myself. And I wanted to build something in Bitcoin. And what you were saying, like, now that you have the tools, you could start this thing up for free, but like, I have a channel now. I can speak to like the world and no one, you know, other than Zoom or Twitter or YouTube, which I've had a show knocked off of, but like, I have sovereignty over that. It's a really wild thing.
What? Your channel was knocked off, or one of your...
Well, no, just an episode was knocked off YouTube. So it's not like I'm operating all this on decentralized platforms.
Yeah.
But right now, for the most part, like, they can't really squash the show, you know? But I'm not even talking about freedom of speech. I'm just saying the ability to put a signal out there and talk to people.
What episode was bumped off?
Jeffrey Tucker. He was one of the... Yeah.
He wrote...
He was behind the Great Barrington Breakfast. Declaration.
And Bourbon for Breakfast is what I've read of his books.
Yeah, he's wrote a bunch. That's probably one of them.
But why was
I'm
that
ashamed I haven't read all of them. You know, we talk a little bit about COVID and the vaccine. He's not like, he doesn't say anything that's crazy controversial. It's still a little controversial. But, you know, one of the comments came up in like 12 hours right away. Like, this is the kind of guy that would kill grandma. It was a comment on the YouTube. And then like 6 hours later, like, I had someone DM me on Twitter, like, you know, your show has been kicked off to YouTube. I logged into YouTube and they're like, your show has been, censored for medical information or misinformation. And I had to go through mind control retraining where they ask you a bunch of questions that are basically, you can talk. Have you haven't had to deal with this?
I've had one ban for my
interview. Did you go through the questions?
No, I didn't do that.
To get your channel back?
They allowed me back on, but I still have a flag, which means they won't kick me up in the algos until I do the mind retraining, but I just refuse to do it. So
I did it just really for the yeses and giggles. I wanted to see what the questions, and they were as Orwellian as it can get. And you have to answer them correctly, all seven, to get your channel back, or correctly in their terms. But basically, you can't, you know, say anything that goes against what the World Health Organization or local health authorities say, as per YouTube. I mean, it's fascinating. And, you know, as a Bitcoiner, you know, you're like, why would I continue to build here? I mean, they could take it away from me at any time. But I'm on the same thing. I got the warning. I got three strikes now. The channel's gone. That's kind of scary. Not scary like, ooh, like, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street, but just kind of like, this is horrible that we live in this world. And so I don't know if the algo took me down. I think it was a complaint from a user if I really had a bet on it, but it might have been the algo.
I had an interview with Pascal Najardi. That was what got my channel nuked, I'm pretty sure, if I remember rightly, talking about COVID and the injections, and he was suing the Swiss president. That was soon taken down, and that interview itself is never to be seen again. Might still be up on audio somewhere. I can't remember. I think
mine's still up on audio.
It might be up on Bitcoin TV as well, because I was kicking a bunch over there at one stage. Yeah, it's a... And that's the thing, right? Because you want to talk about whatever you want on the podcast, but always have a worry in your mind.
Do you ever worry about like talking about something so controversial?
Yeah. And then you're self-censoring straight away. So they've won.
Right.
You know? What the rabbit holes I've been down just most recently. You know, I think I've been at the denial stage for years of what the conspiracy theorists would call chemtrailing. But what the billionaires who invest in SRM call solar reflective modification. And when you realize that, oh, right, so they've got this nice term for it and a bunch of patents, and Gates and Soros have invested hundreds of millions into this stuff, and it just sits over here and the WEF discuss it, and all of the European parliaments discuss it, and these think tank people discuss it under SRM. But if you and I discuss it now and we call it chemtrails, it's like, oh, those fucking weird Bitcoiner dudes, like they think everything's a freaking conspiracy, right. Blah, blah, blah. So you see what they do. The psyop is so strong. But then when you actually read up on that technology that they're trying to deploy under the guise of, if we reflect the sun's rays away from the earth, then the temperature won't rise as quickly because of, you know, we us dirty humans have trapped all the carbon dioxide. Oh my God. It's just so unbelievable. And then when you see the lines in the sky, you can't unsee them again. You're like, So yeah, but should we be talking about this kind of stuff? Is this going to get us taken down from YouTube? Is this going to lose some of our audience members? Is this going, you know, it's all of these thoughts go on.
How do you deal with it in real life? When you meet your kids, you know, the dads and the moms, do they know about Bitcoin? Do they know about the podcast?
Yeah, they do. I've got to the point now where just wait for them to ask rather than, you know, say anything, or listen for the pain point, listen to what they're complaining about, and just, you know, offer the fact that there, you know, there are solutions out there for these kind of problems.
Do they I think of, like, if you tell someone like you're a podcaster, like it's like dirty, it's like telling someone you're a day trader, and they just say, yeah, okay, you're talking to like 14 people. Do they? And then I'm worried, like, we always like, are they going to tune in? Are they going to listen to that one episode about chemtrails and you know, maybe boycott the kids kind of thing? Do you deal with that at all? Or like,
I've certainly thought about it. Yes. 100%. Those thoughts always go through my mind. And they shouldn't, right? Like that's the thing. They shouldn't affect what you want to sit down and talk about with somebody else openly, because you cannot control the way that other person is going to think about it. You know, that is the essence of critical thinking, right? You actually want them to question things about what we're talking about, because that opens up the discussion even further, not just to take it. I mean, how easy would it look if we were like, hey, yo, buy Bitcoin. Okay, I will. You know, like we're not in that world. It's going to take a lot of effort to undo, and this all comes back to the brainwashing and indoctrination gulags of the state education system around the world. We have to unschool ourselves. I mean, Ivan Illich, whose book is back there, Deschooling Society. These aren't new ideas. Murray Rothbard wrote Education Free and Compulsory. Like, these books have been around a long time. And we're probably 3 or 4 generations deep into this mass schooling exercise. So when people do see someone a little bit different or hear them say something a little bit counter narrative, stay away from those people.
I was the kid. I mean, my parents were teachers, but my report card, I would get like 99s, 98, 99, 97, 98. And then the two comments I would get was disruptive and prevents others from learning. And my parents were like, what are you doing? I'd be like, well, fuck them. Like, they're wrong about everything. And what do you mean they're wrong? I'm like, listen, I got everything right on the test, but like, he said this and I don't agree. And he said that, I don't agree. Or, you know, I would crack jokes, or whatever, make other kids laugh. But I'm like, we got the information, obviously. I did okay on the grades, but I was always sort of, you could tell what you were being told. I mean, I loved sort of challenging authority. And I think that's what really appealed to me about Bitcoin as well, is like sort of those people. And when I first kind of heard about it, was challenging my thinking and forcing me to not learn something new, but just to like see something different and reinvestigate it, you know. And then I think it made learning fun again. You know, I was getting burned out working, whatever, arguing with people about this, that, and how to fix the world, what can we do. And what was so great about Bitcoin is you could say, you know, stop, like, you know what, like, I'm not gonna make that whole, I'm not gonna take all that land that we all want to live on and get all of us to agree how to make it better. Like, I'm just gonna go over here and take care of my own little plot of land, and I can get out of this, and I can completely, you know, not on, like, and I think that's where I think my family would see the change is, you know, with low time preference, like becoming less concerned over certain things, and appreciating the low time preference things more, and getting your life back, getting your time back, getting your mental time back, if anything.
You guys moved house, right?
We moved cross country.
Was that something do you think you would have ever done if you'd just stayed in your fiat like kind of life? Or did Bitcoin help you come to that decision? Or was it something
really, you know, it's hard to strip out. Bitcoin definitely, you know, it's like, and once you have a tool, like, you can't say like, oh, I would have done it without this tool. Like, whether you would have or wouldn't have, like, you now have the tool. And, you know, Bitcoin gave me a lot of more faith and conviction in just decisions I was making. It was a very difficult time. But I think I would have made that decision without Bitcoin because of the just things were going with COVID and certain rules and laws and the way my kids were affected. But Bitcoin let me manage that risk of giving up my job, because it was originally to do it. I gave up my job and didn't get it back till the other side. And because my dad was getting very sick at that time and ended up dying during that transition. He died like 3 weeks after I got to Florida and we moved to his town, you know. And I remember even just having conversations with him as Bitcoin was near highs at that point and was like going down. And, you know, and my dad at like 81 years old was like, he owned a little, some sats, and he didn't fully understand it. But like, I was like, you know, I'd sold my house and was financing some of the move and inflation, you know, with that. And trying to, you know, he's like, you haven't sold any of your sats, right? No, dad. You know, and it was interesting to see him on his deathbed concerned about and really seeing the, like, Bitcoin maybe as a secret decoder ring, even without his limited knowledge of it. He was one of the people I would really like to talk to about Bitcoin a lot, because he didn't get it at all. And I really wanted him to get it. And he would gradually, you know. But yeah, that move was really hard. And it took about a year, you know, to kind of convince the family and to do it. And I think the big part of the, I think having the show was really also felt like, I hate to say it because I didn't move for the show, but like all the things I was talking about, like, weren't being affected, or I wasn't doing if I, but moving is really hard. You know, I mean, I just did a show with Tom Luongo about comfortable wolves. And I think before Bitcoin, I was definitely a comfortable wolf, like trying to, you know, like, I don't necessarily think of myself as sheep, but I'm not going to fight the fiat system by myself. And I don't think anyone who is fighting it, like Peter Schiff, is going to win with gold. So I'm like, what are we going to do? But it doesn't mean I'm happy with it. With Bitcoin, I'm like, okay, I got a tool now. And then with COVID, like, it was just more horrible things coming your way that you had to fight, whether you, like, you know, the level of uncomfortability was just rising dramatically for someone like me, at least, you know, there's maybe a lower tolerance for just my sovereignty or independence being crept upon, you know. And then my kids being home from school, I was realizing, like, hey, you know, like, my father wasn't saying don't be an educator, but like, I'm still working this job. I don't have all day to educate them. And then when I was getting much more insight into what they were learning about, which was like all rabbits and feelings and bunnies and, you know, no math, no science, no, you know. And so all those things coming together, it was like, we have to move. Bitcoin was a big part of it, but I don't, and that's the thing. And maybe this is my sense of, maybe it's a lack of humility, but I'd like to think like I've always been on this journey. I was always looking for something like Bitcoin. I was always looking for Bitcoin. I was just, you know, and that doesn't mean that like I was someone who was like, you know, cypherpunk. I'm not saying like I was like on that tip. I was just saying I was always looking for more freedom, or just being not, I don't want to be boxed in, you know, but I wasn't necessarily like a revolutionary either. Bitcoin fit in nice that way. It's like this peaceful thing, mm-hmm. you know, because I don't think necessarily people who are laying down arms are going to slay Goliath right now. You know,
no.
And Bitcoin, I think, is the Second Amendment of money.
you feed it if you fight it as well, right? That's the thing. And it's just like it.
Right.
Just ignoring it and opting out of it is the peaceful, the peaceful revolution. And like, okay, what do I need to sacrifice? My dollars. Okay, no problem. They're sacrificial. Goodbye.
I mean, it was a simple A-B test in a lot of ways. You know, you look at this Bitcoin thing and you're like, okay, it's, when I came in, it was worth like 5,000 a coin. You're like, okay, that sounds like a lot of money. And you read a little history and you're like, oh yeah, it was this guy who spent like 10,000 Bitcoin to buy like a pizza. And now like it's completely inverse. Like now like a month has gone by and it's $10,000 to buy a Bitcoin. And like, which way do I think this is going to continue to go? Is this a fluke? And you know, you start, oh, it's Beanie Babies. And then someone's like, dude, Beanie Babies wasn't fucking software. And you're like, okay, no, that's a really good argument. Like a really good argument. And you're like, okay, Amazon crashed more than 90% three times. And the only people that held throughout that whole thing were Jeff and his parents. And no, Jeff's parents only held because they loved Jeff. But Jeff knew that what he had was different than pets.com and diapers.com. And if you were early to the internet scene, like you might have bet on all these things, like just like shit coins, like, oh, there's pets.com, there's diapers.com, and there's going to be all these different, no, it's just going to be one, it's not going to be one guy who does it all. But like, you know, Jeff knew, and Jeff didn't even know about AWS and what could be built on top of Amazon, right? Jeff couldn't have known that then, but like he knew what he had was more valuable and he had to withstand the volatility. So he started looking at this thing and he's just very clear. It's like, okay, dollars are going, wait, they make infinite dollars. That sounds weird, but now that I said they make infinite dollars, is that true? Mm-hmm. Well, they never told me how many they're going to make. They never tell me when they're making. They don't even let you know the schedule. And the same thing with stocks. Like you might like, as I was very interested in stocks growing up, stocks, companies, picking the best guy. I got to read a book this big every quarter to figure out where they're lying, where they're telling the truth, where the real opportunity is. Then I have to trust that they're going to execute, trust that there's no scandals. Like they're not going to be caught on tape doing something, you know, some no-no, doing something with someone, you know, and like ruin the stock. I gotta trust that they're not gonna sell it to all their friends at a discount and dilute my own, you know, or raise debt or whatever. Where is it in for me? And even if I start a small business, now I gotta take on the whole world there. You know, again, I'm back to working 75 hours a week, putting my whole life into this thing. And maybe the cops don't like my business. So this mobster doesn't like it. Or, you know, a new competitor comes along that I just couldn't have seen. And, you know, no one's using that little disc to hold the pizza box up anymore. And mm-hmm. the patent's gone, you know. And,
yeah, or you get regulated out of it by a bigger company. And, yeah, it's just.
And so now Bitcoin comes along and it's, wow, like I can get my time back. I don't have to do portfolio construction all day. And I could just sit on this thing. There's no repairs, no maintenance, no property tax, no homeowner's insurance. There's no tenants to worry about. I just have to manage the rest of my life and just get now, all of a sudden now, instead of my balance sheet just getting by, like just my income statement needs to get by. I just got to keep plugging along. It's pretty miraculous, you know, and pretty obvious if you think about it, especially in retrospect, like, it's so weird. Like, you know, I talk to people, like you talk about kids and their dads, and I meet these guys and girls all the time, moms and stuff. And you know, and again, I don't think everyone's sheep, but like it's really hard for them to grok that this thing's different than just a stock or a bond or another thing, and that they haven't missed out and they're not too late, and they want to trade against you, not against their future self. So like they look at you and they want to know how much you have or what your buy-in price is, or, you know, and then it's just, they want to bet against you. Like, no matter what I do, like, I don't want to be behind this guy. And my whole life, I got to look up to him. Or I got to sound like them. I got to sound like I'm in a cult. And that's going to be horrible. I got to actually believe in something. I'm going to stand for something. I don't want to do that. Because that's really, really, I think, Bitcoin's like, if you're not going to stand for yourself, who is? And Bitcoin's one of those things. It's like kind of like put your own oxygen on mask on first. And like I fight with people on that. Like, that's selfish of you. Well, I'm going to die trying to save you.
Yeah.
And not being selfish. Like, it's just not going to work out for both of us. And here we are. We've incentivized us all in a positive direction. And then you take all that away. And there's all that BS when the kids, like, honestly, like you talk about surveillance, CBDCs. Like, so now it's like on multiple fronts, like you need capital in society to have freedom in our world because of the education system, the food system. Like in a lot of ways, you have to buy yourself through these things. You can't live in a food desert. That's not going to be healthy. You can't eat healthy at the Dollar General. You know, we have these dollar stores that are becoming the supermarkets of America. And that's just a reflection on money.
Yep.
Like it causes you have to buy the books. Yeah, you have to buy the YouTube subscription so your kids aren't getting bombarded with ads and they could still go on there and find out how to make science experiments. Like,
I tweeted the other day the front page, right? The classic front page, Chancellor on brink of second bailout for banks. And at the bottom there, it's like there's a little snippet, 99p a pint. I'm like, guys, that was only 2009. I could have gone out with a fiver, met my mates in the pub, had four pints, and come back with over a pound in change. Now, you cannot get one pint for £5 in most pubs.
And it tastes the same. It's not a bigger pint.
It's the same product, and it's the same measurement. Like, you know, you're trying.
That's the argument I used to explain this to my parents. I said, Ma, like, you worked your whole life, and at the end of your career, you know, I say a top paid teacher at public school. I don't mean like, you know, she earned her way to some great deal, but she was just, you know, and maybe she made 75K at the end of 25 years of teaching. And now a beginning teacher makes 85K. You know, I'm making these numbers up. I don't know what the real numbers are, but like the point is like, but this person has no experience. And the principal who's supposed to be running the school is like, wait a minute. So cost of teachers go up. Yes. Are they better teachers? Are they going to teach the kid? Am I going to get better math results out of this? Not necessarily. Your results are probably going to go down. So it's going to cost more. And think about anything you're doing in the world, like running a pencil factory. How much is the rubber going to cost me next year? Well, the rubber is going to cost more, sir. Why? Well, the guy who's at the rubber factory, he needs a raise. I don't care. Like, why is the cost of these things going up? Shouldn't it be going down? Are we going to consume less of it? Is it going to last longer in the process? Are we going to get more final product out of it? None of these calculations make any sense unless you're operating on a Bitcoin standard and your unit account is real. And I see this all the time with people in their own personal lives. Like, so, you know, they're like, oh, wow, like Bitcoins, it's $8,000. And a lot of people think a lot about like, I don't have $8,000 of new money. They don't think about balance sheet management and reallocation. Because why? They don't have any conviction in this thing, right? So why would they want to do that anyway? But they're like, that sounds expensive. And it's just hard for them to grok that, you know, that this can be a tool that's going to, you know, just put their balance sheet on steroids, that every dollar is going to go up. It's not about that $8,000 increment or the $62,000 purchase. It's about just putting all your money on steroids and understanding what purchasing power is. But it's really hard to kind of get that through to people because they just see it as another fiat opportunity and you're rugging them, you know?
Yeah, that's what people think when I'm trying to explain it to them. I'm just trying to shill it. You know, maybe I've got some, I'm trying to sell. Even if I gift a little bit, you know, just to show you how it works, download this app, you know, and you still get the.
I know. Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, it's just showing people sort of like that relationship with money and why, you know, you're buying less and you're not getting more. But on sort of on that Bitcoin standard, like your money's going, you know, you look at a house that cost $500,000 and 5 years ago, it cost 500 Bitcoin. Now that house costs 10 Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
So the point was, so like people at that moment in time, they're like, I can't afford this. But because they haven't taken it on then, every new decision is not made with Bitcoin in mind. So maybe they get an unexpected life event 2 years later and they inherit $100,000. But they haven't put in the work because they dismissed it at $8,000. And now that they get $100,000 inheritance, they go out and buy a Mercedes and an in-ground pool for the kids because they haven't, at each time, they're not ready. And that's the opportunity, or you know, the luck is, you know, perspiration meets sort of like the opportunity is your luck. And a lot of people don't create the luck for themselves because they don't put in the work before the opportunity comes. So I've seen another situation too, where people, again, like maybe their company wants to buy their pension out and will offer them a lump sum now versus, you know, a monthly payment in perpetuity 10 years from now. So they say, okay, $150,000 now versus $5,000 a month 15 years from now. Now it's going to take them 5 years to recoup the 150 just in real terms. But they're thinking, I'm going to live for 20, 30 years. That's so much more money in the future. But if you're thinking in Bitcoin, you're like, wow, I can get 2 Bitcoin now and create my own pension and pay myself $5,000 a month in the future.
Where do I sign?
Where do I sign up? But if you're not thinking like that, you're going to let that go right by you because you're thinking in fiat terms. And so that's where the power of this thing is just out there with your calculations and how you manage your life. It's beyond just how big your stack is. It's how you're looking at the world. You know, you're looking through that lens. I mean, that's why I call it the Bitcoin matrix. Like you can leave that fiat matrix and think in Bitcoin. The way you look at food, like, you know, a lot of times, like you pick up a jar of food and you're like, this is the healthy one. And yeah, some company slapped the healthy label on it or bought that healthy company. And now it's crap food. And you have to do your own research and verify. You have to kind of take that Bitcoin mentality to everything. And same thing with all your financial deals. If you're not thinking of Bitcoin, you're just going to blow it.
So difficult to get people there, man. But when you do, so how often are the epiphanies still dropping for you? Because here you are, you're like a good, well, how many, almost 200 episodes into the podcast, you've had some of the most incredible conversations of your life, like I have, with people that have just bent your mind, either on the conversation or through their books or through other podcasts that you've listened to them and then thought, I need to get those people on the pod. And it still happens to me. I still wake up at like 3 a.m. with the laser eyes on. I'm like, no, how did I miss that? Like it's honestly, when we say the Bitcoin rabbit hole is never ending, it's true. Because as it unlocks one little facet or faucet of thinking, it would unlock another, then another, then another, then another. Have you had any recently that you
Yeah, definitely. Like the comfortable wolves things from Tom Luongo, where he gets very mad if you call everyone sheep. And I really felt that struck a chord with me trying to explain why some people are just not as angry as I am or haven't moved. It's because they just have a level of comfort that's different than mine or higher tolerance. That was very insightful. It's really led me to be more empathetic and understanding when people don't get Bitcoin or care. You know, they're like, look, I just bought a new house. I could afford this house payment. Like literally, I just got everything I want in life. Like not meaning like they're retired, but they're like, I just want to be here, bro. My wife's happy. We got the house. Like the kids got the new yard. Like we're situated. Like now you got this other thing that you want me to deal with. I have empathy. I mean, the revelations maybe come a little less few and far between, but so many. I mean, anytime I get to put out a killer clip is usually some sort of revelation for myself, you know, and a lot of them sneak up on you. Maybe you do a show and then like 3 months later, like you're saying at 3 a.m., you're like, whoa,
that's
really
thing.
Interesting. And I still have a lot of those moments. I mean, Bitcoin really kind of.
My 18-year-old daughter said she caught me laying on the couch the other day, just leafing through principles of economics, and something I can't remember the sentence. I'm like,
that book blew my mind,
motherfucker! Like one sentence, like, and I'm tweeting it, and I'm copying the page, underlining it, blah blah blah. And my oldest says to me, I tried to read the book. I just can't. Is it because I'm too young? She's 18. Is it because I'm too young? I don't understand it. Is it because the vocabulary? Is it because I'm not so interested in like the content, you know? And I'm like, just read the pages. It will come. Right. It will come.
How much would you have killed to have that book at 18?
Oh my God. It will come in 2 weeks, in 2 months.
Because I think that's a book. I think that book helps you with high school.
Yeah.
Like just thinking about how high schoolers act and sort of like, especially ones that are like, why aren't they following the incentive structure of everyone else? And then, I want my son to read it basically every 10 years when he starts at 13, mm-hmm. or every 5 years. I think as you grow, I think you would look at that book differently.
Of course. And Lynn life Alden's experiences. Book, and what yeah. I was trying to tell her is like, you're gonna come up against, you're going to bump up a life experience and your right. mind is going to flash back to a paragraph in this book that's suddenly going to make sense to you. And you can come back and read it and you will be like, right. You know, that is the same epiphanies that has been dropping for me throughout my whole Bitcoin journey.
I think with the pod though, and this was something that was very difficult for me, it was documenting this journey. And I think it's going to be interesting to look back on the time capsule at some point and see how wrong I was. And wrong, I don't mean like directionally, but like, whatever, just so much. And you know, it's very exposing in that manner mm-hmm. to share your journey and share your questions. Yeah, but the epiphanies still
and
come
and that's
a lot.
One thing I'll ask you about, because we all suffer from a certain amount of imposter syndrome, and I cannot for the life of me keep up. No one can, and be very wary of anybody that claims to be a Bitcoin expert, listeners, because like all this ordinal stuff that's going on right now, I can't keep up with this stuff. I couldn't tell you what it is technologically, but I can tell you what I feel about it ethically and morally. And for me, it's wrong, like what's going on.
Right.
But, you know, somebody will come at me from a technical background and bitch slap me all over the place. Or someone's got to come in. I'm thinking, huh, well, which one of these conversations do you host? Do you host them all, or do you go with the one that more ethically is aligned with you? How much are you willing to challenge those ethics? And right now I see a lot of weird stuff going on Twitter where a lot of people are going to start burning their reputations over this kind of stuff. And it's like, it's really sad to see. So yeah, I'd love to know how you think about, I mean, not that one specific, but yeah, like yeah. many others where like, you know, you feel as though you're completely out of your depth and you really have no idea what you're talking about, but you want
to. Well, I would say a lot of it, I mean, like just in terms of, you know, a lot of these like security, privacy, I mean, I'm interested that they're not my, I'm more interested in the philosophy, the economics, the macro finance. So I chase the topics that I'm interested in. The ordinals thing I think is interesting. I think it's trendy. It's not necessarily the thing I want to discuss on a weekly basis. I love what Ocean's doing. I think that this is actually more important than the ordinals thing in terms of that this decentralization of mining pools.
Yeah.
I think is a real Achilles heel and under talked about, under misunderstood, under debated, all that. And I think it's the ordinals thing kind of is like a red herring, and a lot of people kind of don't understand what's really at stake. I think I'm not into ordinals. I'm not for ordinals. I think inscriptions are kind of interesting, you know, but it's not the interesting for me right now. I don't think the ordinals is interesting at all for me. It's JPEGs. I don't care. I don't even care about the debate. And so I'll gloss over some of those tweets, but I haven't done a lot of shows on that just because I don't think it's deep enough for me. And I think that other people can cover some aspects of that very well. But I think the Ocean thing, I'm going to talk to Bob Burnett more about that. I want to have the mechanic on and Luke. I'm involved in that project. And I think the mining thing is crucial. And I think the ordinals things plays into it. I think it's an attack. I do think it's an attack. I think it's a bit of a state-sponsored attack. I think there are bad actors behind it. I don't think there's a large gray area here. I have a lot of conviction about it, but I'm not the one who's going to argue it. I'm not going to spend the time figuring out the arguments for it. I do agree with some of the people who are speaking out in the way I'm leaning, but it's not for me. I want to vet other things or do more research in other areas right now. Maybe that will come up more. I am trying to get around the ocean and the decentralized mining pools, and ordinals will fit into that, of course. And I understand how it's a big part of it, but other than that, I mean, it's like NFTs for the whole NFT side of it. I just have no interest in it, like that whole sector. And I think a lot of it's like noise and aside from the long-term attack that's happening, which I think is very important. I'm trying to gather my thoughts for that conversation and get up to it.
But. Yeah, no, it's, and the thing is, it will suddenly be dead and it'll be a new thing everyone's screaming about.
Right. Right. And that's why I'm not going to chase all of them.
No.
And I'll do a show when it's like, when it feels evergreen or we can really lay it. Sorry about that.
No problem.
Oh, man. Yeah.
We just closed out that part of the conversation anyway. So yeah, I was just about to start wrapping it up. I'm going to head off and go and cook some dinner, but I can't let you off without asking you and having you answer the final question. And that is, if you had one last orange pill left to give to somebody, who would you give that to and why?
I would give that to my middle brother. I would love for him to get Bitcoin at a level that was meaningful. I think that would probably be the way I could maybe impact the world in the greatest way, I think, someone close to me. And then I would just go from there. Maybe my brother-in-law after that would be great. Sister-in-law, people close to me. That would be what I would do.
Yeah. Awesome, man. Awesome. And the guy before you, he took a deep breath, thought about it 30 seconds. And for him, it was his father. And I'm hearing a lot of these answers. You know, we've moved on from the early days of, oh, give it to Elon Musk, give it to the Pope, give it to the president, give it to the head of the, you know, Federal Reserve or whatever. No, fuck these people. Really.
Bring it back. And I think if we family. All just start with the people next to us.
Mm-hmm. One person at a time.
Because someone's going to be next to them, and that will be their responsibility.
And this is what I try and help people understand. And I put it on Twitter a lot. It's like, you know, especially when the price starts running, the number of people that join the network goes up every day. That is the number go up technology.
Right.
That is what we are here for. So anything else is noise. I mean, it might be a bit of fun. We can dunk on the economists and whatever else and high five each other on Bitcoin Twitter. I'm down for it. I love it. And I get involved in it too, but one person at a time. And if you're not having that conversation with your nearest and dearest, and you're not hosting a Bitcoin meetup or supporting one in any way, shape or form, or finding your local plebs, a lot easier to do these days. Get into a conference, get in front of Bitcoiners. It's so huge because then you get the impetus, you get the, not a conviction because you're already there. You get the courage, I suppose, to keep going because it can be a lonely place. Orange pilling those around us is the best thing we can do for sure.
Yeah, I agree. I just love to see my loved ones and family and friends just get it. And I say that because it sounds arrogant, but I would love for them to see what I see. I say to them a lot, like, you know, if this thing is 10% or 1% of what I think it is, like, you owe it to yourself to look at it. And if I'm like completely wrong and I'm crazy, mm-hmm. just put in an hour and come back and tell me how, so you could save me, because I'm trying to save you. So maybe you owe to save me. And I don't, you know, I try not to give out advice too often. It's the one thing I talk to friends and family about is Bitcoin, but it's hard. It's not easy.
Here's a little mind bender. When someone says to you, you know, what if you're 100% wrong about this? You're like, what if I'm 99% wrong about this?
That's what I say. If I'm 1% right, like where I think this is going, you owe it to yourself and your loved ones.
Mm-hmm.
But it's amazing how people, it's just, you know, it sounds again like a stock tip, you know, and they don't want to sound like you. They also, they're afraid. Like, you could send someone some Bitcoin. Hey, here's $10. I want you to see what it's like. Now you've just completely devalued the thing you told them is the most valuable thing in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, you know, this thing is so valuable. You got a bunch around it that you could just send to people for free. It sounds like reward points, you know, and they want to find their own Bitcoin. They want to bet against you. It's really hard. It's really hard to convince people that you're actually coming from a place of love and not from a place of smarts or telling them what to do or, you know, because a lot of people, the way I interpret it, a lot of people are like, what kind of car should I buy? And they always tell you, yeah, the car they bought. They never like wanted, what are you looking for? Like, whatever they have is perfect for you.
Exactly.
Wouldn't ask me a little bit about myself? Like, do we want the same things? No, what I have, you want. And the same with advice most times. Like, what should I do with my life? You should be a lawyer. That's what I wanted to be. You know, and they might not even know it. So it's hard for people to get, like, I'm just doing this out of pure altruistic goodness reasons. And I believe in it. And, you know, slap me in the face if I'm wrong. Help me. But, you know, it's just like, nah. If you're wrong, I'll let you be wrong, and I don't have the time to figure it out for myself. Like, I don't even know. They don't care enough to be right or figure it out. I don't know. It's hard.
All right, Cedric, how can people come and listen to your podcast and reach out to you on Twitter?
Yeah, well, on Twitter, at Ced Yungelman, CedYungelman, Bitcoin Matrix, everywhere you can download audio, and on YouTube, and Twitter, _BitCoin Matrix, MATIRX.
All right,
this
man.
Has been such an honor, Daniel. Really, it's been a pleasure. I've been looking up to what you've been doing for a long time, since the very first episode of mine. I've been looking to your show and to your Twitter account and following you, so it's been a real honor.
Thank you. Thank you for everything that you do. And thank you for carrying this message forward. Thanks for sharing a beer on the podcast. It's always nice to hang with Bitcoiners. And let's hope we get to meet again in real life. I won't be getting across to the States, I don't think, this year. So maybe 2025 will be the best time. And who knows?
You got it.
You might even be freed from your fiat role and doing full-time Bitcoin. Fingers crossed.
We'll see. We'll get rid of those golden handcuffs soon.
Exactly.
All right.
See you, Cedric. Thanks, man.
Peace. Today's episode, with me as the guest interviewed by Daniel Prince, is brought to you by River, the preferred choice for buying Bitcoin. Hit me up with any feedback, since I'm not usually the one doing the talking. Love to hear what you guys think. You can support the Bitcoin Matrix podcast with a boost on the Fountain app and by writing a 5-star review wherever you listen to your pods. That would really help me get the word out and help new listeners find the show. And thank you for tuning in. Keep building, keep stacking, and always be laser focused out there. This is Cedric. Peace.